One of my favorite personal guests, Nurse Joyce Riley, passed away in 2017, and she will be next on Coast to Coast AM. The late nurse, Joyce Riley, was a registered nurse and has investigated the truth about the Gulf War illness. Joyce was an advocate for all veterans and citizens experimented upon by the government. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. This hour we're going to spend with Nurse Joyce Riley about a very important subject. Here's an example. Suicides among U.S. Special Operations Forces, including the elite Navy SEALs and Army Rangers, are at record levels, according to U.S. military officials, citing the effects of more than a decade of what they say hard combat. But what else is going on? A number of military coming down with PTSD, toxic combinations of antidepressants. Joyce Riley, of course, has been watching this for a long, long time. And Joyce, since we've been talking about this for so many years, it hasn't gotten any better, has it?
It's gotten much worse. In fact, and thank you for the opportunity, George, we are waiting right now for an onslaught of suicides that are going to be hitting. It is so bad. I don't think people have any understanding of what that 22 suicides means a day and how many people that affects. It is so important to realize that not only, and I went back and studied that that quote-unquote study that was done on 22 suicides a day, mm-hmm. and I was shocked to find out that there are a whole lot of what are called non-lethal and non-fatal events that take place also. In fact, in 2011, there were 16,000 a month, which comes to about 53 a day of non-lethal or non-suicide, effective suicides, in essence. So that brings a total to, you know, like 70 or 80 a day, which is shocking, absolutely startling. Why are all these people committing suicide? Well, we've got to go back and look at what we've talked about over the past 10 years, and that is that the U.S. military decided back in about the late or mid-1990s to start medicating the troops that came back from Gulf War I, regardless of what was wrong with them. I don't care if you had a bladder infection. I don't care if you had a bad back. You were given a Psych-Eval first. Now, the military's been strongly utilizing psychiatry since about World War II and gotten worse over the years. And with this, what we're seeing now is that nearly 80% of the troops are either offered or placed on one of these psychiatric drugs. Gosh. So the linkage of the psychiatric drug with the ailments just doesn't make any sense. You come in for a bad back and you get Seroquel, which, by the way, is called Seroquel, but in the military they call it Seroquel because of the number of cardiac deaths that occur as a result of it. So what we're seeing is between the number of suicides a day and the non-lethal suicides a day, in other words, the attempts at suicide, huge numbers we've never seen before. But if people do not link that and realize that it is related to the drugs or related to the number of people that are relegated into the psychiatric category, then they don't understand where this is coming from, because it's not PTSD necessarily. Because there is no objective way to diagnose PTSD. And a lot of this information I was shocked at. I would like to say I did this, but I didn't. And I have no relationship to this. But there is a documentary called The Hidden Enemy, Inside Psychiatry's Covert Agenda. And I am going to tell you, it turned me upside down in the things that I learned. It made me realize how much worse this problem is than we had ever imagined.
It's huge.
Huge. With the numbers of people that are committing suicide, and get this, not only the adults, but we all know that children have a tough time in the military. Their dads are gone. Their moms are gone. They miss them. They're so sad. They don't want them to be gone. They're afraid they're going to die. So what happens is the mothers dutifully or the fathers dutifully take them to counseling or to the psychiatrist. And in 2008 alone, now this has increased over the years, but children of deployed veterans, there were 2 million visits for the children. And get this, 91% of all of those were placed on a psychiatric drug.
Gosh.
Of children.
Joyce, during World War II, I assume they did not prescribe nearly the amount of drugs that they're doing now. So I assume the suicide rate was lower?
It was much lower, much, much lower. They didn't even have these kinds of drugs that they were utilizing. So, you know, it, the more that they met, this is, goes right coincides. It coincides with the number of medications that are given, the number of prescriptions that are given, and the numbers of deaths and the number of suicides. Here's another thing that I found out from that study that was done is that a majority of the troops that committed suicide did it 1 month after going to the VA. Now, that's shocking because that means that they were probably placed on a drug at the VA, and then they committed suicide a month later. Now, let's talk about active duty people. Now they are being given these drugs prior to deploying, at least 30%. We know 30%, and a lot of the nurses say it's a lot higher than that. So they, before deployment, and they're even told that if you don't take the drugs, you don't deploy. They put them on these drugs, these SSRI drugs, which increase violence, increase suicidality, increase the tendency for homicidal behavior. And these are the things that you don't want in a group of people. You want to be able to manage a gun, handle themselves appropriately in another country, and bring democracy. But what happens is these troops are given 6 months prior to deploying of these drugs. They need to be monitored every week when they're on these drugs initially, but they're not monitored at all. They're just placed on the drugs, and they're sent to fight a war. They're given 6 months' worth. Now, in some of the suicides and some of the homicides and overdoses, and a lot of these that should be considered suicides or should be considered deaths related to the drugs are really from the poisonings and the overdoses, unintentional overdoses, because some of these troops, and understand these drugs should never be given in combination. They've never been tested in combination. But some of these troops are given as many as 24 of these drugs. So what we're seeing at Fort Hood, we're going to be seeing again.
All over the place.
No question.
And we see what's happening in schools, Joyce, with over-medicated kids.
Without a doubt. But this is by design. There is no way that the military says, gee, we had no idea what's going on with these troops. They know it. But the pharmaceutical companies are so strong in what they are able to do with the military. You know, the military in World War II decided that they wanted to have, they wanted to invite the psychological or the pharmaceutical companies in, and they wanted to be able to have a kind of a closed group to where anything that happened that really wasn't all that good could be considered classified and nobody would ever know about it. They would have an unlimited number of subjects and an unlimited number of dollars to work with. So here comes the pharmaceutical companies.
Joyce, why do you think they're over-medicating? Some big deal with a pharmaceutical company or what?
I think that can be one part of it. But I think also that if they can relegate their injuries, their problems, their whatever to some kind of mental problem, then they don't have to deal with it. In other words, the very fact that the military might be creating these problems vis-a-vis the whatever, chemicals, biologicals during the first Gulf War, depleted uranium more so during the second Gulf War, because it removes liability. And I have seen ridiculous cases where they take a person that's got an obvious organic injury, obvious problem, and they relegate them to the PTSD category just so they can remove them from any kind of responsibility. That also has to do with the pensions. It also has to do with compensation. But if we take those suicides that we were talking about and the attempted suicides, which comes to about 75 a day,
gosh,
you have to ask the question, where would we allow that to happen anywhere? If we were at war in Somalia and 75 of our troops were dying a day, we wouldn't tolerate that. We would do something about it. But in this case, what we're seeing here is the military is not only tolerating it, but doing more of it by over-medicating these people. And I would encourage any military person especially to go to cchr.org. That video is there available. You can see it there. But the video is going to help you understand how dramatic and how serious this problem is. CCHR.org did an amazing job of doing this video. I wish everybody could see it that's getting ready to join the military. Every parent could see it, because just like with Specialist Leon at Fort Hood, you know, they admitted that he was on Ambien, but that was it. And they said that because of, you know, legal reasons, they couldn't tell the other drugs. Well, why can you tell one drug and not others? And yet Ambien has been known for people to sleep eat, sleep That's drive, right. sleep have sex. What's wrong with sleep killing or sleep suicide? So they're not understanding, or people are not understanding just how serious the drugs are, especially in combination. And by the way, of the PTSD labeled people, 40% of them never saw combat. So how does one explain they've got post-traumatic stress disorder from a war when they didn't see combat?
Good point.
And I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, and I'm not saying it's not real, but they also don't want people to know about the toxic burn pits. They don't want people to know about what happened in the Gulf War, one, and the vaccines, and they don't want them to know what happened with respect to depleted uranium for sure in Gulf War II. So listen to this. This is amazing to me. In comparison to the civilian population, the military uses 30 times more of these drugs than the civilian population.
Gosh.
Unbelievable.
It's crazy.
And they know what they're doing. And these troops who get on them can't get off because they're addictive. So when they get on the drugs, and I want to make this very clear to any listener out there that is taking these drugs, do not go off of a cold turkey. You can't. You get addicted to it, and it will increase your symptoms if you go off of it. And do not do that unless you have a good physician who knows what he's doing.
Yeah, but chances are, Joyce, and I agree with you, it's the physician who probably prescribed it in the first place.
And you know what? It's not a physician. It's usually a psychiatric aide. It's a psychiatric intern. It's a nurse who happens to be seeing people in clinic. It's wrong what they're doing because there is no follow-up. So they put them on the drugs. Let's say they put them on Zoloft or Seroquel or whatever. They put them on, let's say, one of the drugs. Then they come back later and they say, I feel just as horrible. I don't feel any better because maybe they had an organic problem that wasn't taken care of. And so they say, well, let me add one more. And then let me add one more. And like I said, I've known some of these people that were on 24 of these drugs. They were walking zombies. You could not create a killer, George, any better than what they're doing right now. You could not create a killer. There's more, if you just do a search engine on military suicides, military homicides.
It's huge.
You're not going to believe what you see. Now, the military knows this. They're not stupid. I'm not the first one to say this, obviously. And this documentary, The Hidden Enemy, oh, my goodness, it will turn your life upside down once you realize what the military is doing to the people. And then they say, oh, that horrible military person, they just went crazy and killed people. No, the drugs kill people. The drugs create that. And every person I visited in prison, in jail, every military person I visited because of a capital offense has all told me the same thing. It was those drugs. And I don't even remember doing it because of the amnesia, the depersonalization that occurs. So I just want to say to the veterans, don't commit suicide. Don't give up. Don't think that there is no hope, because there are doctors that understand this. And if you see that documentary, The Hidden Enemy, you are going to have an understanding that it's not you most of the times. It's the drugs acting within you.
Let's take some calls here, Joyce, for you for the time we've got left. Dave in Indianapolis, Indiana, east of the Rockies. Hi, David. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, my son has served two tours of Afghanistan and a tour of Iraq, and he has PTSD. But he says him and everyone in his unit that suffers from PTSD, he's one of those bomb poker type people, but he says they have to be off their meds for 4 months before they can get deployed again.
I don't know about that. I've not heard that at all, because mostly when you get on those drugs, you can't get off. And I've heard all kinds of stories about how they just maintain them. So I don't know. I mean, that to me would not be medically safe to bring them off of those drugs either. But they are deploying them with the drugs, so I can't understand why they would have that, why they would say that.
You know, whose idea do you think it was, Joyce? Some individual to over-medicate these troops? I mean, some one person you think made some kind of edict?
Well, I think there is a desire within the... Remember, in Gulf War I, they didn't want anybody to know there was a Gulf War illness, and this turned out to be obviously true, everything I said. But they made a decision then to hide the Gulf War illness, to not tell the truth to the public. That was a DOD decision. And so the same thing has happened now, because when I learned in 1998, I learned from all the troops that I had interviewed, and I mean, there were hundreds of them, 80% of them had either been placed on or offered Prozac. Now, that means that we sent 80% of the head cases to fight a war over in Iraq? I don't think so. So there was a conscious decision. Some of the colonels, some of the generals, excuse me, that are involved in this also have very close relationships with pharmaceutical companies. And it's very scary because they're the ones promoting them. For instance, the Seroquel drug is not safe at all, and it has been found to not be even effective for PTSD. Yet one of the generals, I could give her name, but one of the generals is now recommending that it be given to them. Now, they are also doing these psychological evaluations. And by the way, some of them are even created by Pfizer, by the psychological company, by the pharmaceutical companies. So, I mean, it's just so inbred that, you know, and I'll even mention her name, Dr. Elspeth Cameron Ritchie. She was formerly the top psychiatrist in the U.S. Army. And when she was serving in the Army, she praised that drug, the antipsychotic Seroquel, for being so useful for the treatment of anxiety, which it is not, and causes sudden cardiac death. And she also was funded by two drug companies in doing this. So there is an inbred situation here that needs to be cleaned up.
All right, Joyce, let's take some more calls here for you. Deborah, Inglewood, Colorado, and Deborah's a first-time caller for us. Hi, Deborah, go ahead.
Hi, my question is related to why aren't they considering therapies such as EMDR and biofeedback rather than over-medicating?
Well, it's a good question, and that's what a normal, sane person would ask. But unfortunately, there's so many people that have ended up with problems as a result of the first and the second Gulf War. About 1 million people are sick, and they don't have the manpower, nor do they have the desire to treat them. So they relegate them to seeing some psychiatric intern who gives them the drugs and tells them that's the answer to your problem. There are something like 890,000 calls received by veterans' hotlines. There's no way they can possibly deal with all these people and take care of their problems. Now, their problems are related to perhaps, number one, PTSD, real, from what they did over there, that they're sorry that they did it. And then number two, the fact that they got involved in a military doing things that perhaps, you know, was not what the military was for. And then, of course, getting involved in taking the drugs. And then they have a real problem, and they just can't get over it. And that leads to the suicide ideation or the homicidal ideation. And then that leads to them, unfortunately, not being taken care of by the VA. And thus, you know, the fact that I gave the statement that after 1 month of being at the VA is when they commit suicide, and that's probably because of the drugs they were placed on. It's too expensive, it takes too much time, and it would take too many therapists to do the right thing by these troops. So they just really kick them to the side of the curb, and that's the sad part.
I would guess, Joyce, that some of the military folks must come to you emotionally distraught, crying, everything, don't they?
Oh, it's unbelievable. You know, like I said, they're sorry for what they did. They didn't know what they were getting involved in. They came back a basket case. They can't get any better in doing anything at all. They try to exercise. They try to go to church. They try everything. But if they're on these drugs, the drugs take over. And the drugs create, like this guy Leon, the specialist Leon at Fort Hood, no one had a negative thing to say about him. And that's the tragedy, George, is most of these people are really incredible guys and women that do this, that either kill themselves or someone else. They're amazing people. There's never anything negative said about them. And they go off and just kill. No motive. And that's where we need to start asking, what's the motive? And if there is no motive, then let's look at the drugs. And then by law, they need to do a forensic autopsy.
Nurse Joyce Riley, we lost her last year, shortly after this interview that I had with her. And what an amazing champion for veterans and veteran rights. She is truly missed, truly missed. We will be back with more as we pay tribute to fallen guests on Coast to Coast AM. Ray Bradbury passed away at the age of 81 in 2012, but we had a chance to interview him, the great sci-fi writer. Ray Bradbury graduated from high school in Los Angeles, the class of 1938, and he became a full-time writer in 1943. In all, Bradbury has published more than 30 books, close to 600 short stories and numerous poems, essays, screenplays. His short stories have appeared in more than 1,000 school curriculum recommended reading anthologies, and his work has been included in 4 Best American Short Story collections. Ray has received several awards, which include being nominated for an Academy Award and winning an Emmy Award. He was also the creative consultant on the United States Pavilion at the 1964 New York World's Fair. In 1982, he created the interior metaphors for the Spaceship Earth display at the Epcot Center in Disney World, and later contributed to the conception of the Orbitron space ride at the Euro Disney in France. He has written some phenomenal books, including The Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man, Fahrenheit 451, and Something Wicked This Way Comes. They've all been turned into blockbuster movies. It is my privilege to introduce to Coast to Coast Ray Bradbury. Hello, Mr. Bradbury. How are you?
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Me too. Me too, indeed. You know, when Mark was telling me that he had an opportunity to get you on the program, I got to tell you, what a delight, indeed, talking to a legend like you, Ray. I've got to ask you, with the mind that you have and the stories you have written, when you were a small boy, did you always have this interest in sci-fi and science fiction?
Well, I loved writing. I loved libraries. I fell in love with Edgar Rice Burroughs' books. Tarzan and John Carter, Warlord of Mars. I loved Buck Rogers, the comic strips, because they took me into the future. So I fell in love with the whole idea of being some sort of fantasy writer when I was very young.
Ray, when you wrote The Martian Chronicles, what did it take to come up with that story? I mean, for people, some people who may not know this book in this movie, it's probably one of the greatest sci-fi stories I've ever seen, I've ever read. How did you do that?
It's all God-given. It's in the genetics. We're all born with a certain talent, and I had a certain talent that I began to see it when I was in high school, and I began to take care of it. The thing is, if God gives you a gift, you've got to make sure that you pay attention and don't hurt it. So all of my life, I've tried to take care of this talent, which came to me in my genetics. That's how you do it. You go with what is given you.
And take care indeed, because what, you're 84 now. You're about ready to be 85 in August, aren't you?
That's right, yes.
We've got a birthday. I think we'll have a live birthday party for you on Coast to Coast.
Well, I would love that.
And I've got to tell you, Ray, when I was a young lad and I used to watch The Twilight Zone religiously, I Sing the Body Electric truly had such an effect on me. It was just the way it was done, the way it, that whole moment was conceived of the children and the mother, the robot type. I mean, it was just fantastic. How did you get the idea for that?
Well, I got it because I got tired of people saying they didn't like robots, and you realize we're surrounded by robots. When you go to a motion picture, when you go to the theater and see a film, it's being projected by a robot. The projectionist and the projector up in the projection room, those are all robots. They automatically repeat truths over and over and over again. So if you love the truth that's being projected, you keep going back. So I wanted to write a short story in which I said, look, there are good robots and bad robots. And the electric grandmother was a robot who kept repeating love. And over again, she could give love to the world and make secure the love of the children in the family.
And that's
what I wanted to do.
And as the family grew older, you know, the grandmother stayed the same. And
that's right. Yep, yeah.
And it, which is almost like life, Ray. It really
that's
is.
Exactly it, yes, yeah.
You also did the Ray Bradbury Theater, which these were 65 classic episodes.
Oh, it turned out beautifully. I trusted these people. They promised me they would do a fine job. They kept after me for a year, and I doubted what their word was, and they finally proved themselves. So they let me write 64 scripts, and they produced them in New Zealand and Australia, in Paris, in London, and in Vancouver, and they all came out beautifully.
Well, a little bit later on, we're going to open up the phone lines because I want you to really get an idea of some of the lives that you have touched with the work you have done. In everything you've done, Ray, which project has been your favorite? Do you have one?
No, I love them all. Look, I have four daughters. I have four granddaughters and four grandsons. So I don't play favorites. So as it is with my family, as it is with my stories, that I loved doing what I was doing at the time, and then I moved on to the next project. But my favorite, of course, of all, really, is doing the screenplay of Moby Dick for John Huston.
Oh, that's right. That was good. You know, you wrote a long time ago this quote, and I'll never forget it. It was about the Martian Chronicles, and you said, there is life on Mars, and it is us.
That's right.
And do you believe that, or was that part of the sci-fi in you?
No. We are already, we have our photographic equipment on Mars, and we're going to follow it sometime in the next 20 years. Live men, live astronauts are going to land on Mars, and we will become the Martians. We will civilize Mars. We will build it, and we will live there for the next 10,000 years.
I think you believe, like we all do, Ray, that there is intelligent life out there in the universe.
It's somewhere, but it's too far away. Right now, all of the intelligent life that we know is right here on Earth.
And I got to tell you, talking to you and Mark Zakri, there's two of them right there. Ray, when you were writing your books, The Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man, and all the others, did it ever get frustrating for you, or did it just flow very easily?
Look, I'm a happy writer. I love the process of writing. I love the joy of writing. So it's never been a problem. I don't understand writers who turn it into a job, and they sweat over it, and they worry, and they ruin their work. They're too self-conscious. They're too intellectual. So just relax and do it. And then when it's finished, then look at what you've done. And if you love it, everything's fine.
What kind of technique did you use when you started writing? Did you go into a special room at all?
No. I can write anywhere. I write out in the desert. I write in L.A. I write on the Greyhound bus. I write on trains. I write in the middle of the night. The whole process is fantastic, and it's most loving.
Has the technology made it easier for writers now, where now they've got computers and everything else?
No, you don't need a technology. All you need is a pen and a pencil and a pad of paper. You don't need a typewriter. You don't need a computer. All you need is a pen, and you begin to write.
Hey, what was it like knowing and doing some work with Rod Serling?
Well, I didn't work with him. I gave them scripts, so I don't know anything about him.
Really? You never met him?
Well, I helped him start the series. I had dinner with him one night 35 years ago, and at dinner he said, I'm going to start the series, but I don't know anything about fantasy and science fiction. I said, come with me, come home, come into my basement, and I'll give you a bunch of books to take home to read. So he came home with me, and I took him down my basement, and I gave him copies of wonderful books by Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont, Roald Dahl, John Collier, all these wonderful people. So I said, you take these home and read them, and get them into your bloodstream, and this will be your series, Twilight Zone. So that's what he did, and that's how Twilight Zone came to be created.
Ray, you've been on this planet nearly 85 years. If you had to look into that crystal ball mind of yours, what do you think the next 85 years would be for this planet?
They're going to be glorious, because we're going to go back to the moon, which we should never have left, and we're going to go off to Mars. And when we land there with our live astronauts, the whole world will explode with joy, because mankind will be moving out in the universe, and we'll have a chance to live forever. That's what the next 85 years will offer.
What was it like for you in July of 1969 when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon?
I was in London that night, and I did broadcast on Telstar with Mike Wallace and Walter Cronkite.
Yeah.
And I was able to say what I believed was true about the effort to go to the moon and to go beyond. It's the most glorious thing that mankind has ever done.
I think Cronkite was so emotional when that happened that day.
Oh, we were all emotional. I cried all night long.
And I've got to tell you, the creativeness for the books that you have written, Ray, in the angles that you have taken. I mean, for example, you know, when you look at Fahrenheit 451 about firemen, where one would assume their job at that point was to knock out fires in buildings, they were burning books.
That's right, yes.
When you came up with that idea, I mean, how did you do that? And what were you thinking about?
You sit down and you write it. If you're excited, you believe in the idea, you don't think about it, you do it.
Ray, I'm getting right now, before we go to the calls, thousands of messages for you from this computer system we have here. I just want to read just a couple of them to you.
Oh, yes.
One is from Mark in Chicago. He said, I got to work once as a technician with the Organic Theater Company from Chicago in 1977. Ray came to the show, wrote a few lines for the play, The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit, and it was the greatest we had ever seen. How about that?
It was a wonderful... wonderful occasion, and a lot of those people have become very well established since. So it was a great event at the Organic Theater.
Here's one from Bonnie Jean, a teacher now in Illinois. Thank you, Ray Bradbury. I've read everything you've written. Now as an English teacher, I teach your books and share my admiration of you with my students. As a writer, I take your words to heart. You know, you've had such an effect on people. It is just, you know, you can't describe
wonderful. It. Thank you.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, Mark. Hi, George. Thank you very much for being there and taking my question.
Sure thing.
Mr. Bradbury, it's indeed an honor, and God bless you.
Oh, thank you.
I hope that you have a great birthday. My question to you is, as I recall, you wrote The Pedestrian.
That's right, yes.
Yes. And I wonder what, in this society, you now think of what you wrote.
Well, I'm glad that I wrote it because I was upset. That story was written one night. I had dinner with a friend on Wilshire Boulevard, and when we came out and we were walking and talking, a police car pulled up, and the policeman got out and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, the policeman questioned me, and I promised to go home and never walk again.
Well,
so I went home and wrote the story because I was so upset by being questioned by policemen who doubted my capacity as a pedestrian. So that story led into Fahrenheit 451. So thank God that policeman questioned me 55 years ago because he caused a novel to be written.
Well, there was so much with regard to television sets, but I couldn't help but think of what it would be like for everybody to be watching the same channel at the same time. And I hope that I did see Fahrenheit 451. I've seen everything that you've done. And all I can say is that it's been really great. And I appreciate you taking my call.
You're welcome.
And I hope that you have a wonderful year.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
You were saying, Ray, that one of the loves was working with John Huston in the film Moby Dick. What did you really like about that?
Well, the fact that he was one of the finest directors in the world.
Absolutely.
I saw the Maltese Falcon again the other night. It's a masterpiece. The performances by the people, Mary Astor is simply incredible, and which means she had the ability as an actress to perform, but it had to be that John Huston as director helped to mold and shape her performance and free her to become the character. So And Bogart, too, has never been better. Absolutely wonderful.
And, you know, you haven't slowed down. You know, 84, 85 years old, you keep going. You're going to book festivals. What's next for you?
Well, I'm writing some more plays. I'm hoping to move into a new theater in Culver City sometime in the next 2 months. So I've got to write some new plays to go into that theater. I often wonder what people do with their time. So I use my time by writing new things.
Good for you. Let's pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with Ray Bradbury and Mark Zacree. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Mark. I am incredibly nervous because I had never thought I'd get to talk to one of the people that actually inspired me to write. And I really want to thank you for that, Mr. Bradbury. You're an amazing man. And my question, I have a question and maybe a quick verbal favor, if I may. My question is, you're incredibly prolific. And when I was reading about Mark Twain, sometimes he would get, the writer's block, as it were, and he would just skip to another story.
I was just wondering. Right. He was right.
So is that something that you followed suit with? Because, I mean, as they were making the background, you set the goal to make 50 stories per year. Did you just ever get stuck and say, okay, skip it, we'll go to this one, and then when I get the time or the ambition for it, that I'll take care of that one when it comes around?
Sure, I'm working on two novels right now.
Next up, two more Coast to Coast guests who have passed on. We will be right back.